From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Robbie Feinberg with the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, October 31st, 2023.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by Eastern Basements, a division of Maine-owned Eastern Mold Remediation. Offering crawl space repairs and waterproofing, easternbasements.com.
The shock of last week's mass shooting has given way to questions about what authorities knew about the mental condition of the suspect, Robert Card, and how police responded to concerns from both family members and U.S. Army officials. Maine Public reporter Kevin Miller has obtained documents offering new light on those questions, and he joins us now for the latest. Kevin, walk us through these new documents. What did they reveal about Robert Card's mental state?
Well, they showed that Robert Card's family and members of his Army Reserve Unit really had growing concerns about his paranoia, his aggressive behavior and talk, and then his access to guns, and that they communicated some of those concerns to police as early as last May. Members of Mr. Card's family told the Saginaw County Sheriff's deputies in May that he was hearing voices and that he thought people were calling him a pedophile and that he'd actually recently retrieved more than a dozen of his guns from a relative's house. And then those documents also, they shed more light on this incident that we've talked about in the past, where back in July, he was hospitalized for 2 weeks in New York while he was training with the reserves because he was behaving so erratically. And then just a month ago, police were told that one of his friends and fellow reservist was worried that he was becoming so paranoid and angry that he actually might, quote, snap and commit a mass shooting.
How did police respond to these concerns? Did they take any action?
Yeah, so back in May, the sheriff's office talked to the family and to leaders of Mr. Card's reserve unit in Saco. But based on the narrative that we're seeing here in these police reports, Robert Card's brother said that he and his father would talk to him. And then when the deputy offered to tag along, the brothers thought that that might exacerbate the situation. Reserve leaders, meanwhile, they also said they would talk to Mr. Card, but it's not clear what happened, and the Army has been pretty reserved about what they've sent out so far. But then if we flash forward another 4 months to mid-September, deputies received more concerning reports from his fellow reservist, and they tried to talk to him twice at his home in Bowdoin. The first time he wasn't there, and then the second time they thought he was there, but he didn't answer, and the deputies eventually backed off because the family had warned them that he frequently answers the door while armed. But then family again said they would try to take Mr. Card's guns away from him. And a reserve leader basically suggested that police should let Mr. Card, quote, have time to himself for a bit, and that the reserves were trying to get him into treatment. But then it doesn't look like the sheriff's office made any additional attempts to interact with him after that. And then the mass shooting happened about 6 weeks later.
Do we know if there are any additional steps that authorities could have taken here?
Yeah, obviously that's the big question here. Sheriff Joel Mary with the Saginaw County Sheriff's Office says that he believes his agency, you know, acted appropriately and that they followed the what he says is the proper procedures for what was essentially a wellness check in his eyes. But he said they will go back and they'll evaluate how everything was handled. And, you know, hindsight is always 20/20, but I'm sure some will argue and are arguing that they should have pushed more assertively to talk to Mr. Card or gone back to his house more times. But instead, it seems like officers, they deferred more to the family and the reserve leaders that they would try to address things.
And this also clearly raises questions about Maine's so-called yellow flag law. The law is designed to allow law enforcement to petition a judge to temporarily remove an individual's access to firearms. Was that procedure activated here?
It doesn't appear to be, no. So what the yellow flag law does is it allows police to begin that process of taking someone's guns away from them after they've been taken into what's known as protective custody. They go and they get a determination from a medical professional that this person poses a danger to themselves or to others. A judge then makes a decision about whether to grant that request to temporarily confiscate the guns. And then there are follow-up hearings and check-ins over the next year, but there's no evidence that that process ever happened here.
Can we say if it should have been activated here?
Yeah, certainly some are making that argument, especially when you have a friend telling police that he's concerned that Card might snap and commit a mass shooting just 6 weeks before that happened. After a deputy failed the first time to find Mr. Card, The sheriff's office actually sent out an attempt to locate alert that called him armed and dangerous and then mentioned his threats to shoot up the reserve facility in Saco. These alerts apparently go out all the time, you know, dozens a day, I understand. And Card never showed up in Saco, so police there didn't have any reason to use the yellow law, the yellow flag process. And then no other law enforcement apparently reported anything back to the sheriff.
Is this raising additional questions about the utility or the implementation of the state law?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Maine's law is more restrictive than the red flag laws that we see on the books in dozens of other states. In a lot of those states, family can actually directly petition the courts to take away someone's guns if they're behaving dangerously or if they look like they might harm others. But here in Maine, family have to go to the police first, which some advocates for red flag laws say that actually could be a deterrent because people might be leery about going to the police. In this case, again, we did see some of Mr. Card's family members approach the police. But then again, the police reports also suggest that other families were trying to kind of handle this internally.
Has Governor Mills offered any response to these new questions that are being raised?
Well, she was asked about it during a press conference yesterday afternoon, before these documents really became public. She said that they are legitimate questions being raised, but she declined to comment because she said the investigation is ongoing. That led to some pretty feisty exchanges with reporters, mostly national television network reporters who were covering the shooting and the aftermath.
And we want to get at the best answer to how can we prevent something like this from happening, and that includes why did it happen in the first place, and what measures may have been in place that weren't used or were used, and that's what we'll get to the bottom of in due course. Thank you.
It's not necessarily surprising that the governor, who is a former attorney general and a former prosecutor, would decline to go out too far ahead of the investigation on this.
And that was Maine Public reporter Kevin Miller. You can read his latest story on our website, mainepublic.org. Radio silence. That's how one longtime sheriff's deputy described the way Maine State Police provided information to hundreds of law enforcement officers who assisted with the manhunt after the mass shootings in Lewiston last week. The comments were part of a scathing Facebook post that has since been taken down. But as Susan Sharon reports, his criticism isn't universally shared and is in fact being disputed.
In the post, Sergeant John Gay, a 24-year veteran of the Androscoggin County Sheriff's Department, does not hold back. The upper echelons of the Maine State Police Major Crimes Unit and command staff are utter clowns, Gay wrote. I wouldn't hire them to manage the morning rush at Dunkin' Donuts, much less an investigation of this size. Gay went on to say that law enforcement officers were, quote, left idle after Maine State Police assumed command and shared little about the direction of the investigation.
So I woke up Sunday morning and I came across the Facebook post. I read it, let it sink in.
Androscoggin County Sheriff Eric Sampson says Sergeant Gay later called him, explained his frustration, and said he had removed the post.
I said, okay, and that was that. Obviously, I had a conversation with him. That was between him and I. It's over, it's done, it's out there. I'm not going to share an opinion one way or another. At some point, there'll be an extra after-action review meeting, and we'll learn by consensus what we did well and where we could improve.
Just across the river from Lewiston, Auburn Police Chief Jason Moen says he and other law enforcement chiefs showed up at a Lewiston command center, which was soon under the lead of state police, for briefings several times that night and in the days that followed.
You know, when I was there, I would get briefings from the Maine State Police on the status of the investigation, status of the manhunt. I would then be able to go back to my station and update my people.
Moen says the hard part is when there is no information to give. In this case, he says the suspect was not providing a trail to indicate he was on the run, using his cell phone, credit cards, vehicle, for example. So the focus became the area near where the car was found at the Miller Park boat launch in Lisbon Wednesday night. Moen says he was disappointed to learn about the critical Facebook post of state police and of a published report that suggests state police did not start tracking the suspect for 12 hours after that.
From my observation, that's completely inaccurate. Within an hour of the incident happening, the suspect's photo had been published. And within, I would say, 90 minutes, he had been identified. and we were then putting a name to a face in a vehicle. And that information went out to everybody, to all responders, very quickly. And so there was no waiting on 12 hours to be in tracking him. That was instantaneous. As soon as he was identified, people were up on him trying to track him.
Androscoggin County Sheriff Eric Sampson says he was part of a large team that arrived at the Lisbon scene Wednesday night.
We surrounded the car. The TAC team showed up. They asked us to form a perimeter. And then we all took different positions throughout Lisbon to monitor activity while that went on.
Sampson says there were concerns that the suspect could be in the car or the woods nearby waiting to ambush them, or that he had staged the car to explode. These were all possibilities. He says the TAC team approached the car with special equipment, and his team moved out to expand the perimeter further.
What decisions were made after, as far as tracking, I don't know. I wasn't involved. There was a helicopter above us the whole time, and that's about as far as I have for inside information.
In Lewiston, a spokesperson for the police department couldn't comment specifically on the allegation, but he said that police need a warrant to search a suspect's car. Without it, any evidence they find can be thrown out if the suspect is later tried in court. And getting a warrant can take time because it must be signed by a judge. Records released late Tuesday afternoon by the Maine Department of Public Safety show that a daytime search warrant was issued for the car on Thursday, October 26th. Both Sheriff Sampson and Chief Moen say they are proud of the response of all law enforcement, dispatchers, and other first responders who sprang into action after the shootings and were determined not to give up until the suspect was found. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Late this afternoon, the Maine State Police issued a statement. The agency says it was an all-hands-on-deck response to take care of the injured, secure the crime scene, and search for an individual who committed horrific crimes. It says it followed best practices after the suspect had been identified and his vehicle located. As in any critical incident, Maine State Police say there will be an after-action review to identify lessons learned. For now, its focus is on the investigation and the support of victims and their families. Last week's mass shooting has put Maine's two U.S. senators' positions on guns under the microscope. Republican Senator Susan Collins and Independent Senator Angus King both oppose an assault weapons ban pending in the Senate, yet both say they favor some type of restriction on high-capacity magazines. And on the same day of the Lewiston shooting, both voted to protect military veterans' access to guns if they're unable to manage their personal finances. Steve Missler has more.
Last week, while the gunman who killed 18 people and wounded 13 others was still at large, Senator Collins joined Democratic Congressman Jared Golden for a press conference in Lewiston that was ostensibly designed to highlight their efforts to help bring the fugitive to justice. But when Golden addressed reporters, he delivered an extraordinary statement for a politician in a state where gun rights advocates have long influenced the decisions of elected officials.
To the people of Lewiston, my constituents throughout the 2nd District, to the families who lost loved ones, and to those who have been harmed, I ask for forgiveness and support as I seek to put an end to these terrible shootings.
Golden, a conservative Democrat and combat veteran, was apologizing for previously opposing an assault weapons ban. He announced that he's reversing that position, and he's since penned a 1,600-word explanation for doing so. He might not have intended it, but Golden also provided a contrast to Collins, who was subsequently grilled by the British press for holding firm to her opposition to the assault weapons ban currently pending in the Senate.
I think it is more important that we ban very high-capacity magazines. I think that would have more input and more effectiveness.
While Collins voted for a previous assault weapons ban that expired 19 years ago, she opposed an update that would have widened the old ban from roughly 17 different gun models to more than 150. She says she did so because the ban was more about a gun's appearance than its functionality.
And it was based not on lethality, but more on how they looked, on cosmetic features. And I did not think that that was appropriate.
Senator Angus King has offered similar criticism of a Senate proposal that also outlaws magazines that hold more than 10 bullets and requires background checks on the sale and trading of assault-style weapons excluded from the overall ban. And last week, both senators supported an amendment to a spending bill that critics like Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat, say will allow military veterans to buy guns even if they have been found incompetent to manage their finances.
This is a death sentence for scores of deeply mentally ill veterans.
The amendment curbs the ability of the Department of Veterans Affairs to refer veterans' mental health issues to the background check system used by gun dealers. The amendment was championed by the National Rifle Association, but Murphy described it during last week's Senate debate as a dangerous change that will put mentally ill veterans and others in harm's way.
These are veterans who have been judged to be mentally incapacitated, and let me put a finer point on it. One-third of the veterans we're talking about in this category are diagnosed schizophrenics, and this amendment allows for every single one of them to have their gun rights restored.
Collins says the amendment would have had no impact on the Lewiston shooting because the shooter was an Army reservist, not a veteran receiving VA benefits. She also says that it's unfair that veterans with a fiduciary managing their benefits could lose access to guns while other benefit recipients of programs like Social Security don't.
And it's just not right to equate the ability to handle one's finances with mental illness that poses a threat.
King was not made available for an interview, but his written statement largely aligns with Collins's view that the current VA rule denies veterans due process while squeezing off their access to guns. He wrote, quote, "It would be truly ironic if service to the country ended up diminishing one's rights rather than enhancing them," end quote. Collins and King also argue that the amendment still allows a judge to determine whether a veteran is mentally fit to own a gun.
The amendment still allows for the current system of adjudicating a veteran's ability to have a firearm based on his or her mental health.
Scrutiny of last week's vote highlights how the Lewiston mass shooting has shifted the power balance between gun control and gun rights, at least for now. King, who is expected to run for re-election next year, is reportedly working on a gun control proposal in response to the killings. But it's an open question if his bill will upend the well-worn pattern of mass shootings, legislation, then status quo. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Meanwhile, state and city workers are set to clear Portland's largest tent encampment on Wednesday morning. Nicola Grisco reports.
The encampment has more than 100 tents and has grown since May. City and state officials have since cleared three other sites around Portland, prompting unhoused people looking for a place to go to move to Marginal Way. The site has been the focus of a city-led crisis response team that had set a goal of finding shelter and housing for those living on Marginal Way, and eventually closing the encampment altogether. The Maine Department of Transportation, which owns the property at the Park and Ride lot, had announced a little less than a month ago that it would clear the encampment on November 1st. The ACLU of Maine called on city and state officials to cancel these plans, arguing that the removal of the encampment violates the constitutional rights of unhoused people and jeopardizes their health and safety. Social workers plan to arrive Wednesday around 8 a.m., City and state officials are expected to begin their work around 9, starting first at the Park and Ride lot, before moving to areas along Marginal Way and then to nearby Somerset Street, where tents are also pitched. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nicole Grisco.
In other news, Oxford County Sheriff deputies shot and killed a man on Monday night outside the Rumford Police Station. According to the Sheriff's Office and Rumford Police, just before 8:30 p.m., officers were interviewing a person outside the police station who was concerned that a vehicle was following them. During the interview, a vehicle that matched the description drove to the station, and a man confronted officers with a rifle. Officials say 23-year-old Sean Diamond of Canton was shot and transported to Rumford Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. The two officers involved in the shooting are on administrative leave while the Maine Attorney General's Office investigates. Maine's Gambling Control Unit says that sports betting in the state will officially launch on Friday morning. According to the Maine Department of Public Safety, rules for sports wagering have now been adopted, and operators and suppliers can begin advertising and registering users by tomorrow. Governor Janet Mills signed a law last May legalizing sports betting in the state. The measure grants Maine's four federally recognized tribes exclusive licenses to run mobile sports betting apps. Three of the tribes have partnered with Caesars Sportsbook to operate apps on their behalf. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. And coming up on Maine Calling at 11 o'clock on Wednesday morning, we'll discuss family caregivers and the billions of dollars in unpaid care they provide their loved ones. I'm Robbie Feinberg. Thanks for listening.